Let's start with our meeting. The meeting is officially open and you are all welcome. Apologies, Minister Dlamini Zuma has apologized. Honorable Young Blood has apologized. Honorable Dlamini Thubazana has apologized. Honorable Mutau will be delayed. Honorable Tomela, I think, as he has apologized last week, is still hospitalized. Those are the apologies. Are there other apologies? Honorable Nebot.
Thank you, Chair. And good morning, everyone. Honorable Lissoma also apologized. She sent an email.
Honorable Lissoma apologized. Let's move to item 3. Any other? Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm honored to be. My apology, Chair, is that I won't be able to finish the meeting. I have another committee engagement to the Portfolio Committee of Justice.
Oh, thanks, Honorable Mao, for the apology. But be that as it may, I think we'll try to move faster so that we benefit from your presence. Deputy Minister, we are getting into item 3, briefing by DPSA on the progress made with regard to the development of the public administration management regulations. Over to you, Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I'm not going to take too much of time, and just to say thank you for welcoming me to the meeting and congratulations for your appointment as the Chairperson of this Portfolio Committee. This morning we're going to be looking at the briefing on progress with regard to development of regulations for Public Service Administration Act, and I have officials from the department that are going to be presenting. Over to you, Kenny.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister, and good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. Firstly, allow me to indicate the Minister is in Cabinet this morning, therefore she is not with us, as well as the Acting Director General supporting the Minister this morning. Chair, thank you. Our presentation this morning is going to look at the purpose and background, the Public Administration Management Act provisions. Clearly, what are the key areas that we need to identify and to bring into effect? Our understanding and the way we're approaching the implementation of the Public Administration Management Act is through the introduction of regulations. As we introduce regulations, it'll bring in different aspects of the Act into effect. We also identified a few challenges which we want to draw the committee's attention to and identify the way forward in terms of how we want to deal with the implementation of the Act. In this regard, firstly, as indicated by the Deputy Minister and the Chairperson, our intention today is simply to give progress in terms of the implementation of the Act and where we are. In particular, we want to look at ethics and anti-corruption management and the regulation governing ethics and anti-corruption across the three spheres of government. The second area we want to look at is norms and standards in terms of Section 16 of the PAM Act, compliance with minimum norms and standards in terms of the public administration, as well as the establishment of what we're calling the Office of Standards or the Office of Standards and Compliance, OSC. We all know that the PAM Act was signed into legislation in December 2014 by the President. And as indicated, it seeks to provide a legal framework across the three spheres of government to bring in some degree of uniformity in purpose, in ethics and integrity management, amongst others. No provision of the Act to date has been brought into effect. And I think it's important for us to note that because although signed in 2014, there's been a great deal of work that has been done since then. We've been busy working around 2015 in identifying the areas that we need to focus on. And secondly, at that point, decision was taken, let's not start going into local government in preparation for the local government elections. So the idea was to wait for the local government elections of August 2016 to be over before we can start dealing with consultation and implementation. It's important to note that the PAM Act, in terms of establishing uniformity across the three spheres of government, the intention is not to interfere with the independence and autonomy of local government. So everything that we do will be done in consultation without impacting on the autonomy and independence of local government. So we, at that point in 2015, 2016, we said it was difficult to introduce legislation, introduce regulation that involves extensive consultation at local government level in the middle of preparation for local government elections. So that delayed us a little bit in 2016 as well. 2017, we drafted the first set of regulations, and we'll come back to that and speak about it in terms of ethics and anti-corruption management. And that was dealt with during 2017. In terms of the areas we want to focus on for this morning's discussion, the Public Administration Management Act provisions, in particular the prohibition of public service employees conducting business with the state. The PAM Act is extending this prohibition to special advisors and all public administration employees. When we talk about public administration employees, we're talking about all employees in the national sphere of government, provincial sphere of government, and the local sphere of government. There seems to be a slight challenge between the presentation that was distributed and the presentation that's loaded. Chair, I mean, can I speak to that or speak to the presentation I have in front of me? And in this regard, we refer to Section 8, which is conducting business with the state. And the section, employee includes person contemplated in terms of Section 12A. Remember the current public regulations, the public service regulations and the Public Service Act, in all of the work we do around conducting business with the state is limited to public service employees, that is national and provincial government. PAMA extends that to include employees that are appointed, well, they're not employees, but special advisors appointed to ministers. So it includes them, and it includes all employees at local government level. So that's what we're trying to do. By the way, it also criminalizes the activity of conducting business with the state. So those are the two areas that we're trying to bring into effect. As indicated, a contravention of subsection 2 is an offense, and any person found guilty of the offense is liable for a fine or imprisonment. That's not in the provision of the Public Service Act, or is it a provision in terms of the regulation. So the PAMA criminalizes conducting business with the state. And we also indicate that it constitutes serious misconduct, so the process must be conducted in terms of misconduct management and discipline management in the department. Section 9 is the next area that we're looking at as well. These are just the provisions of the Act itself, so I'm just drawing attention to the provisions itself, and then we'll go into the actual regulations. Section 9 deals with financial disclosures. Remember, it's about interest disclosure. It's disclosing your financial interest by public employees. The PAM Act extends the obligation to disclose financial interest to all public administration employees. Interestingly enough, it goes a step further, and it also includes spouses. So you disclose your financial interest as an individual, as an employee, as well as that of your spouse, and we define a spouse to include a partner, a person that's living with you as well. Section 9.1 then defines the areas to be disclosed. Shares and other financial interests in an entity, sponsorships, gifts above the prescribed value other than gifts received from a family member, benefits and immovable property. Failure by an employee to comply with the obligation referred to in subsection 1 constitutes misconduct. So we entrenching the management of ethical behavior in the public service, and we're entrenching the management of conflict within the public administration. Finally, in terms of section 15, this is all in relation to ethical conduct within the public service or public administration. Is your public administration ethics, integrity, and technical assistance unit. The purpose of this unit is to support the administration, to support the advocacy work, to set norms and standards around ethical behavior within public administration, the three spheres of government. The unit is established in terms of legislation, and the intention by the Minister of Public Service and Administration is to ensure that the unit is up and running during this financial year to provide that support to departments across the three spheres of government. We still need to determine the organizational form, whether it's a government component, whether it's a special service delivery vehicle, whether it's a government department, or whether it's a public entity. But the intention during the course of this year is to incubate the unit within DPSA and then determine what form it's going to take. As indicated in the legislation itself, the unit has the following functions: to provide technical assistance and support to institutions in all spheres of government regarding the management of ethics, integrity, and discipline matters relating to misconduct in public administration, to develop norms and standards on integrity, ethics, conduct, and discipline in public administration, to build capacity within institutions to initiate and institute disciplinary proceedings into misconduct. You notice that's one of the challenges within the public service at the moment, the delays in the finalization of disciplinary cases. D, to strengthen government oversight of ethics, integrity, and discipline, and where necessary in cases where systemic weaknesses identified to intervene. That's where departments are finding it difficult to deal with disciplinary cases, for us to assist and, if necessary, to intervene in it and take over some of those cases. To promote and enhance good ethics and integrity within public administration, and to cooperate with other institutions and organs of state to fulfill its functions under the section. In this regard, we need to establish very close working relationship with the National Prosecuting Authority, as well as the Department of Priority Crimes, the Hawks, in relation to criminal matters linked to discipline management. The Act goes a step further and places an obligation on all heads of departments that when an institution discovers any act of corruption, such corruption must immediately be reported to the police for investigation in terms of any applicable law, including the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, PECA. Issues of misconduct emanating from criminal investigations must be reported to the unit and the relevant head of institution for initiation and institution of disciplinary action. The purpose of reporting to the unit will make sure that all of those cases are concluded in terms of, one, the disciplinary matters, which is the internal matters, and two, that if there's any element of corruption involved or any element of criminal matter, it's referred to the relevant investigating body. Chair, just to note, honorable members, what we are currently doing is working with NPA together with Hawks to establish some sort of a specialized unit so that we make sure these cases that they will be dealt with speedily. In terms of the criminal matter. So that's the work that we're currently doing. Notwithstanding Section 5B, every institution has a responsibility to ensure that it deals with matters relating to misconduct without undue delay. So in other words, we want to make sure it's done within a stipulated time period. The head of the institution must report to the units on steps taken in respect of 5B, all of those investigations, disciplinary matters, and so on. We require regular reports. the unit may perform its functions in section subsection 4 in respect of a national department or national component in consultation with the executive authority of such department or component. You notice the act is written in such a way that the unit, and in terms of DPSA and the role DPSA plays, it's more the coordinating role. It's setting the norms and standards that covers the public administration, but the implementation is left to individual departments and individual municipalities. We will then, as the unit, as well as the Department for Public Service and Administration, through its Office of Standards and Compliance, monitor the implementation thereof on a regular basis and report to relevant oversight bodies. You'll notice that the municipality, with the concurrence of the Municipal Council, or upon the request of the relevant Municipal Council, will be responsible for management at their own level. And as I indicated, the Act also provides that the Minister must report to Parliament twice a year on the activities of the unit in relation to all activities that the unit is responsible for. The second broad area of work that we're looking at for immediate implementation is the work around compliance with minimum norms and standards. That is Section 17. The Office of Standards and Compliance is established in terms of Section 17.1. It's very similar to the unit on ethics and integrity and discipline management in the public service. This unit is also established in terms of the Act, and the intention is to introduce both these units during 2018. As I indicated, it's simply to establish them, and thereafter we'll look at how we incubate them within DPSA, thereafter determine what institutional model is going to follow, or the institutional framework is going to follow, together with the staffing and so on going forward. The functions in terms of this Office of Standards is to evaluate the appropriateness of norms and standards and the basis of measurements as determined by institutions in relation to public administration and management. Promote and monitor compliance with minimum norms and standards determined by the Minister in relation to public administration management. Advise the Minister on the execution of his or her duties with regard to the determination of minimum norms and standards contemplated in terms of Section 16, then, as well as the enforcement of these norms and standards. They will also be responsible to conduct capacity and functionality audits of skills, systems, processes, and advise on capacity building initiatives across the three spheres of government, which is public administration. The Office of Standards will be further responsible for the developing and implementing an early warning system to detect public administration non-compliance and report in writing. That report must be at least every quarter to the Minister on the performance of the Office's functions, and as directed by the Minister on the progress made in the investigation and finalization of matters brought before the office. Chair, honourable members, this part here just simply compares Section 16 of the Public Administration Management Act, which talks about the responsibility of the Minister for Public Service and Administration in relation to setting norms and standards, and in relation to Section 3.1 of the Public Service Act. You'll notice there's a great deal of similarity between the two. In Section 16 of the Public Administration Management Act, the Minister may prescribe minimum norms and standards in relation to the promotion of the promotion of values and principles in terms of the Constitution, capacity development and training, information and communication technology in the public administration, integrity, ethics and discipline, the disclosure of financial interest, measures to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of institutions, disclosure of information relating to pending disciplinary action and concluded disciplinary proceedings where the employee was found guilty, and any other matter necessary to give effect to the administration and implementation of this Act. And you'll note in Section 3.1 the responsibility of the Minister for Public Service and Administration in terms of the current national and provincial government. It's the functions of the public service, the organizational structure and establishment of departments, the conditions of service and other employment practices for employees, labor relations, health and wellness, information management, electronic government, integrity, ethics, conduct and anti-corruption in public service, and transformation, reform, innovation, and any other matters to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of the public service. So there's some elements of overlap between the two. And there are some areas when you talk conditions of service and so on, there's no, it's specific to the public service that the minister is responsible for. That's just to give an indication as to the additional responsibilities placed on the Minister for Public Service and Administration in relation to PAMA, Public Administration Management Act. Moving forward, Chair, Honourable Members, as we indicated up front, that for us to give effect to the various provisions of the Public Administration Management Act, the intention is to follow a phased approach in implementing each of the sections, and we will implement this through the introduction of regulations. The first set of regulations that we've gazetted during the course of 2017 was the Public Administration Management Regulations on Conducting Business with the States and on Disclosure of Financial Interests. This was done during 2017, it was gazetted in 2017. We received some comments during 2017. Part of the debate and discussion there was it was limited to public service. The idea was to implement it in a phased approach, so we gazetted first for the public service and thereafter to extend it to local government. After the consultation process, it was believed that it's appropriate to do both together, to implement or to look at gazetting both for national, provincial, as well as local government. And we've had one or two consultation meetings towards the latter part of 2017-2018 to take that process forward. So in relation to part two, conducting business with the state, the regulation proposes the following. Heads of institution must develop, maintain, and communicate policy on conducting business with the institution. Institution must keep a register of entities that conduct business with institution publicly available and must also be known to all employees, as well as persons engaged in supply chain management, employees dismissed for conducting business. So all of that information must be made available, must have a register for them, and they must be publicly made available. Executive authorities and heads of institutions have a duty to report contraventions in terms of Section 82 of the Act, as well as to investigate. Executive authority has to submit a composite report to the MPSA on 1 October of each year on all alleged contraventions of Section 82 of the Act. So in other words, all contravention in terms of conducting business with the state, so that we will have a record, monitor, and report in relation to that. In relation to Part 3, the regulations went further and spoke about disclosure of financial interests. As indicated, the Register of Specified Employees' Financial Interests, DG, must be submitted to the DG of the Office of the Public Service Commission, Financial Interests of Senior Management, Special Advisors, and their spouses. So we did not remove the role of the Public Service Commission in relation to senior managers. The heads of institutions, for all other employees, their financial disclosure must be disclosed to the HOD of the department. The disclosure must be done electronically, in other words, using the e-disclosure system. And we also prescribe the period. The period that one discloses for is normally the previous financial year, so for the entire previous financial year. There's an obligation on employees to make a full disclosure and to immediately notify the EA or head of institution of any possible conflict of interest. So in other words, if you are a director of a company that intends conducting business with the state, you need to bring that to the attention of the head of department immediately. All conflicts of interest must be managed. The regulations outline the process to be followed when a conflict of interest is identified. So we go into great detail in the regulations around all of these issues. We also identify some of the challenges in terms of the implementation thereof. The cost of implementing financial disclosure is not a cheap exercise. Currently, we are implementing financial disclosure using the e-disclosure system. The intention there is all employees disclose on the e-disclosure system, and we verify or validate that information electronically as well. So we got information from the deeds office, and that's submitted electronically to us. We get information from eNatus electronically as well, and we get information from, CIPC, Commission for Intellectual Property, Companies and Intellectual Properties Commission. They submit information. So we validate that information. Unfortunately, the deeds office charges us 12 rand a record, so that information is not free. SIPC information and eNatus information come to us free. currently, if we have to pay for 1.3 million employees, it's costing us 16 million rands a year. If we have to do it for public administration, including local government, it's going to cost us more. So we're busy looking at what's the best way of managing this, the cost implications. One of the things we're looking at, just to share with the committee, one of the things we're looking at is for the deeds office to give us the information once off, and thereafter to update on an annual basis when there's a change. So we don't have to buy the information on an annual basis. We only buy once and update where necessary. I mean, the simple principle is the majority of public servants will buy a property and they will live there for quite a few years. They're not going to change every year. So it's a question we need to deal with. In terms of the way forward and where do we go to from here? As I indicated, the PAM regulation regarding employees doing business with the state and financial disclosure will be combined to deal with both public service and municipalities, and that's the work we're currently doing and we want to extend during this year. While the regulations to effect Section 8 and 9 of PAM are processed, the following interventions will be undertaken to create an easier path to implement the PAM Act. Chair, honourable members, what our intention during the course of 2018 is to do is firstly to amend the public service regulations. We want to amend the public service regulation to align it to PAM Act for national and provincial government. And we use the same principles and extend it to include local government as part of our consultation process during the course of this year. So we will be reviewing and amending the public service regulation to include regulations on lifestyle audits. Remember, the President has raised this matter of lifestyle audits, so we're looking at how we create an enabling environment through the public service regulation to conduct lifestyle audits. And if we get that right through that process, as part of the PAM regulation, or the PAMA regulation, we will then include the principle of lifestyle audits to include local government employees as well going forward. Consideration to financial disclosure being done once and thereafter resubmitting when changes occur. As I indicated, it's an expensive business to be doing this on an annual basis. One of the things we're looking at is that all public servants over a period of time disclose once. And once that information is captured on the system, thereafter put regulations in place which says if there's a change in your financial position or your financial interest, then you must disclose that information within a period, and we're looking at within 60 days of you becoming aware of a change in your financial interest that you then disclose it. And we will then be able to use all of that information as indicated to conduct lifestyle audits, and we'll be able to use those information to manage conflicts of interest. Remember, the main purpose of managing all of this is to ensure that we limit and we remove any conflict of interest in public administration. So you don't have public servants who are directors of companies wanting to do business with the state at the same time. So it's managing all of those conflicts of interest. The proclamation to bring sections 15 and 17 of PAM Act into operation will be finalized, and that's in terms of the two units, which will see the establishment of the Ethics, Integrity and Discipline Technical Assistance Unit, as well as the Office of Standards and Compliance. That will be operationalized before March 2019. And the strategic framework for public administration norms and standards will also be finalized during the current financial year. We will also introduce the regulations in terms of conducting business as well as financial disclosure for the three spheres of government during this financial year, and the consultation process will be undertaken during this year with all three spheres of government for implementation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Deputy Minister, any comment?
I think the members that you are actually presenting may be comments from me.
Thanks, Deputy Minister and your team. Members, that's the briefing by TPSA on the with regard to the development of the regulations. I will have to note that want to make inputs or ask questions. Honorable Khosa, Honorable Ngama, Honorable Van der Waal, Honorable Nefort, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to our colleagues. And thank you for the presentation. No, thank you so much. I was also thinking the presentation that you have given to us. I'm just having two issues to speak to. Looking at the huge task ahead of the unity to support these institutions in all these spheres of government, what is the size of the unit to ensure that there is sufficient or enough capacity to deal with the issues ahead? And, will the unit maybe have to second its personnel or allow each institution to appoint their own staff to deal with disciplinary measures? And maybe lastly on this one, is there a time frame for the implementation? Because maybe I did not get it to when it's going to be implemented. It's still something that is going to be done. The other issue I wanted to speak to was with regard to the officials who continue doing business with the state in spite of the Act and the public service regulations. What has been done so far to reprimand them? Has there been changes of financial charges, I'm sorry, of financial misconduct? If yes, how many cases are we talking about? And if no, why there hasn't been a charge? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Khosa. Honorable Ngango has to leave. Yes. Forwarded the questions to Honorable Mutau. Honorable Mutau, can you ask the questions or make the comment?
Thank you very much, Chair. As you rightly pointed out, I've been delegated by a superior man, member of the committee, to ask the question. His concern is really about the fact that we're doing all of these things and there are people who whistleblow. Are there any measures to protect people like those? Because many times we cannot get to the bottom of things unless somebody else comes in and talks about it. So we'd like to know whether there is any way in which these people are protected so that we can facilitate the flow of information to the authorities to take the necessary action. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mtao. Honorable Van der Waal.
Okay, thanks. My apology for being a few minutes late, and I have to leave after the BSA is done. Chair, I'm quite concerned because this act was signed off, if I recall correctly, November, December already in 2014. That's 3.5 years down the line. I'm not sure if any in this act has been implemented. And I'll raise it, first of all, we talk about units. When, you know, is it really going to happen? When will it happen? Since what date does the minister have to start reporting twice a year? Is it already expected of her to come and report to Parliament, or must she only wait till after these units are established? Because I think that's what it says here. She must report on the units. But Chair, then I raised the question, and I think we saw early this year, well, 2 months ago maybe, that I think it was 2,708 officials was reported by Treasury still doing business with Parliament or government, and to the tune of about 8 billion rand. So my question would be, if this act is in play, supposed to be, are any charges laid? What happened to that? Is it investigated? Because I just find it very strange that we complain about lots of things, but we never implement the laws we have. So what's the point? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Van der Waart. Honourable Nivot Tresha.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. A lot of the questions have been covered by other members, but just a couple of additions. The Public Service Commission, they already get the e-disclosures. Now, so where does the Public Service Commission fit in with this act, the Palmer Act? How does it fit in? Is it the same disclosure that applies to the act as well? So just that to clarify. And then the act, as well as the regulations, is it applicable to staff in SOEs as well or not? And then, because it includes the municipalities and the struggle with, they struggle with finances and capacity, will this, the technology or whatever is needed for e-disclosure to municipal workers, would, you know, the training of that, does the municipality have the capacity to do that? And then the units that get established, are they going to have the capacity to assist the municipalities as well? And then another question, the units within the national, is it going to be only national, the units, it's on a national level, who is going to see to the various spheres of government, national, provincial and local? Is that going to be the case? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Nivot, Deputy Minister and the officials. Those are the questions and comments. You can respond.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to allow the officials to respond, but to say that in terms of Honourable Mwango's questions about protection of whistleblowers, to say that last year Parliament did pass the Protected Disclosures Bill. It was actually strengthening protection of whistleblowers. So when it comes to whistleblowers, I think South Africa has got enough and tight legislation enough to be in the position to protect whistleblowers. And what is good about that act is that it actually also criminalizes false disclosures, because half the time in public service sometimes you find that the confusion is that people make false disclosures for their own personal ulterior motives, which actually sometimes unnecessarily hurt people. But there is a specific provision within that act to be sure that people who actually present false disclosures are criminalized also. Thank you. Over to you, Kenny.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Chair, thank you very much, Honourable Members, for those questions. We agree, it's a huge task. I think the implementation of the Public Administration Management Act and the regulations and the various institutions and systems that we need to put in place is going to be quite a task. Part of that responsibility, and I think that has resulted in some of the delays in the implementation of the Act itself over this period, was trying to assess how do we gradually bring it in. And the understanding from our side in discussion is we're going to phase in the implementation of the Act to ensure that we have sufficient capacity. Because from our side, once we implement through regulations, we need to have the capacity to support all three spheres of government in terms of implementation. As a starting point, as I indicated, for this year, we're going to prescribe, or through some sort of regulations, we will introduce both the units, the unit dealing with the Office of Standard and the unit dealing with Ethics and Integrity. So they will be established during 2019, and the establishment of that unit will be based on existing staff within DPSA. Remember, we have chief directors and units dealing with office standards in DPSA, so that becomes the incubation, that becomes the starting point. We have units in DPSA, a chief director dealing with ethics and integrity management, and we have a director dealing with discipline management. The idea is to bring those units together to form this unit as a starting point. As we move along, we will have to then determine the capacity they need, and we'll have to build capacity as we grow. So that's the initial intention. As we indicated, part of this process will have to determine its organizational form. Is it going to be a government component? Is it going to be a public entity? What organizational form it's going to take is the work this unit will have to determine, and the capacity and funding it needs to effectively discharge its responsibility. To answer the question, as I indicated earlier, from our side, the unit plays more a support role, a setting of the national norms and standards, setting of the policy environment, putting in place the systems to implement all of these, but the physical implementation thereof, for example, on discipline management, the responsibility will be at institutional level. The intention is not for this unit to take over discipline across the public service. It's not possible. You can't sit in Pretoria and discipline somebody in Ulundi. It's going to be virtually impossible to manage that. So the idea is to put the systems in place, put mechanisms in place to support, but the responsibility for discipline is done at that level. For example, if you look at the Public Service Act, the Public Service Act is very clear. The responsibility for discipline management at a departmental level is a head of department. It's not even with the minister, it's the head of department responsible for discipline management. I think a similar provision is in the Systems Act as well, the Municipal Systems Act. So the responsibility for implementing discipline is at that level. We need to ensure through the unit that that happens, and it happens timelessly. So that's the monitoring and reporting we're going to do through the unit. I'll cover the issue of time frame. So during the course of this year, both the units will be up, and as I indicated, the regulations around ethical behavior, around doing business with the states, and financial disclosure will also be introduced during the course of this year for consultation purposes. Chair, honorable members, with your permission, the issue around doing business with the state, the charges of financial misconduct, all of those issues, is already on the agenda of the portfolio committee. I know we're coming back next week or the following week, I'm not too sure, to do a comprehensive presentation on doing business with the state. Can we defer that to that, or do I need to deal with it now? Because we've got a full presentation on the numbers, the figures, who they are, whatever, so we'll come back to the committee in that meeting. It's on the agenda.
You don't set the program for the committee.
No.
We have a meeting next week.
No, Chair, because we prepared the presentation and now I forwarded it, so I wasn't sure exactly when it is. But no, Chair, that was not my intent. But the question of doing business with the state, yes, remember when we introduced the Public Service Regulation 2016, we then put into regulation that no public service is allowed to conduct business with any organ of the state. And we gave all public servants that are currently engaged with any business activities, either as an individual or through a company involved in any organ of state, in any business involvement, they had 6 months. And that 6 months expired in January of 2017, end of January 2017. And from that date onwards, we've been monitoring as DPSA. We've written a number of letters. We do a report in relation to Purcell, where all public servants are recorded, and we compare that information with what we call the Central Supplier Database. And that Central Supplier Database is managed by National Treasury, and the Honourable Member speaks about those figures. The challenge, however, in trying to manage those figures, at DPSA level and at National Treasury level, it's very difficult for us to say the figures that it throws out, the 15,000 employees that are registered on this Central Supplier Database and at the same time are also registered as Purcell employees. Number of them are temporary employees. So they come in on a part-time basis and they leave. Some of them have worked last 10 years ago on a part-time basis. Departments have not removed their names from the Purcell system. So therefore, they are still reflected as employees. So what we do as DPSA is simply identify all of the employees, both on PASAL and CSD, and write to individual departments to say, we have identified Kenny Govender is an employee in the public service. This is his PASAL number. And based on our information on CSD, he's also appearing on the CSD, so the potential to conduct business with the state. Please investigate and take necessary action. So departments are investigating that, and they were supposed to report back to us. And we are now in the process of compiling a report that to bring back to committee on those issues. So yes, we are monitoring. The figures at the moment show, I stand to be corrected, but it's around between 500 and 600 employees that are registered on the CSD, that are registered on PASAL, and in terms of the supply chain management, are conducting business with the state. So there's about between 500 and 600 employees. But as I indicated, the possibility, it could be public, could be people that have been in the public service 4 or 5 years ago and have since left, and the department has not removed their name from the system. So therefore, they'll still show as public servants. So the departments must investigate and then take action in that regard. Deputy Minister has dealt with the whistleblower protection. Just to take it a step further, remember the PDA, the Protected Disclosures Act, places an obligation on every single employer, including the public service, to put in place a system to protect whistleblowers and to put in place a system for reporting of wrongdoing. So what we're doing as DPSA, and the framework has been finalized, we're busy consulting with departments, and we will be issuing the guidelines during the course of this year for departments to use the framework to establish their own policy environment for the reporting, for the investigation, and for the taking of action in relation to whistleblowers. The second thing we're doing as DPSA through the anti-corruption task team is to establish a special unit that we as departments can immediately refer matters of whistleblowing for a speedy resolution and for speedy investigation. In this regard, we're working with the Special Investigative Unit in particular, as well as the National Prosecuting Authority, to look at the whistleblowing, the protection part of it, as well as support for the investigation part of it. Ma'am, you're absolutely right. December 2014, the bill was signed into law. We started work in 2015. We've done a complete analysis of what needs to be done. And we started some work in 2015. As I indicated, we then not shelved it, we continued work, but in the background rather than the actual consultation process, because we were moving towards the local government election at that point. So the decision was, because the PAMA involves local government to a large extent, there's no way we can implement anything at local government level without a full consultation with local government. And we were moving into local government elections in 2016. The idea was to delay it after 2016. So the first set of regulations we issued was in early 2017, which dealt with the conducting business with an organ of state or conducting business with the state, as well as the financial disclosure. So that was then issued in 2017. We conducted consultation around that, and we're now moving into implementation phase. So during 2018-19, and the finalization of those regulations. But yes, we acknowledge it's been a long time, and we need to speed up activity in this regard. When does the MPSA report? Our understanding is that the MPSA will only report once the units are fully established and the provisions of these legislations come into effect. And my lawyer will tell me whether that's correct or not. So the understanding is we want to introduce the units during this financial year. So by March 2019, both the units will be in place. So the implications for that will be during 2019, the minister will have to report twice in that financial year in relation to the work of the units. The role of the Public Service Commission still continues, even in terms of PAMA. The all senior managers still disclose through to the Public Service Commission. They will still be responsible for the verification, the validation, the management of conflict of interest, the ensuring that discipline management takes place. All of that work was still at that level. So the Public Service Commission still has that role. The only thing we've done is we separated. The Commission deals with senior management, and the head of department deals with all other employees in that organization, because it's going to be very difficult for the Commission to deal with everyone. And DPSA will still play the role of of support. Yes, in all of these things, technology, the only way this is going to work is going to work through technology. We can't do financial disclosures manually and expect to verify. Remember, the information comes to us electronically as well, from CIPC, from eNatus, and from DEED's office. So it's electronic system to monitor and evaluate. But the difficulty is it costs money, because you need big systems to evaluate all of this information, and you need huge storage space to manage all of that information. One of the things we're looking at this year, because if you want to get all public servants to disclose their financial interests, the challenge is the current system, you've got to be logged onto a government network for security purposes. So we're trying to work with CETA to see, can't we develop an application like these smartphone apps? So at any time you can log in, you can disclose, you complete your disclosure, you submit it, but the intention is not to link it up directly to the mainframe. So to have some sort of firewalls in between, and it loads in the evening. So that the teacher in a remote area, or the agricultural worker in a remote area, is able to then complete. So that's the work we're currently doing to make sure that employees are not hindered in the manner in which they disclose. Just to clarify, the Public Administration Management Act and its regulations will not cover state-owned entities. It's only limited to national, provincial, and local government. So that's the three spheres of government. The unit, as I indicated, the unit will be at a national level. And once the units are established, and I think that's part of the work we need to do, do we need to replicate the units at a provincial level to support provinces and local government at that level? Or how are we going to manage this? And we work the units first, let's get it off the ground. They will have to do an assessment. They will have to look at its institutional form. They will have to look at its national footprint and how we deal with it going forward. But I think we also need to be very mindful of the personnel expenditure wage bill for the public administration is under severe pressure at the moment. So you can't be establishing huge units that replicates what should be done at departmental level. So we'll be looking at the optimum utilization of existing personnel. And as I indicated, every single department has personnel to deal with discipline management. They have personnel to deal with ethics and integrity. It's a better coordination and support to those employees to do their work, and I think that's the focus of the unit coursework. Anisha, I'm not sure whether I left out.
Thanks. Any other question? Honorable Mutau.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick follow-up question. It's always something that is worrisome. Well, when you're talking about this unit and we say it will play a supportive role, in other words, it will be monitoring. And then we end up where we are right now with the Public Service Commission. They go in, they find something is wrong, they tell the people, those people who are supposed to do it anyway, guys, fix this. And then time passes and they don't fix it. What happens? Thank you, Jim.
Well, because we are moving towards concluding our presentation, slide 9, Deputy Minister, and on the disclosure of financial interest, it says an employee must in the prescribed manner disclose to the relevant head of the institution all his or her financial interest and the financial interest of his spouse and a person living with that person as if they were married to each other, including all those. And if that does not happen, it's a misconduct. Are you not making life very difficult for people who are not married? Just, I mean, how do you oblige a person that's not married to you, but you stay together to say, disclose, give me all what is here? And the poor person, if does not get that information from the person living with, that is a misconduct. Is that what you, what is the intended objective of this? I understand all well people are married, but you stay with somebody for how long, you don't know. Then the person is doing business somewhere, you go back and say, can you give me all this information? And he does not disclose. But the person who must be disciplined is the one who's a public servant, and not the person who's not a public servant who's refusing to disclose all this information. Well, what's the intention here? Also, you have published in terms of the Code of Conduct containing Chapter 2 of the Public Service Regulations 2016, all matters to do with disclosure. And subsequent to that, as you have indicated, there were transitional arrangements up to 2016 November on the directive on other remunerative work outside an employee's employment in the relevant department as contemplated in Section 8 of the Public Service Act. And further than that, you dealt with the definition of what is an organ of state. All what you have done before here with these regulations, are you saying that there is a lacuna which has to be addressed? Because there are regulations, as we speak, that deals with disclosure in regard to financial interests and doing business with the state. Well, why don't you work on the existing regulations and include maybe local government or whatever? Well, why do you want to develop new regulations, whereas there are regulations as we speak and which are gazetted? So those are my two questions. Thanks.
Maybe let me just try and address the Section 9, Disclosure of Financial Interest 1. Your concern, Honorable Chairperson, to say that why have to put in requirements that actually involves the partner. I think what we need to look at is the situation where we've got to have regulations that becomes a deterrent to possible corruption. You may actually also say that if you've got to request such information from the spouse, it might be difficult because there are certain spouses that may actually not be willing to disclose. But we're just trying to come up with regulations that are tight enough so that they don't leave loopholes of actually promoting corruption in terms of the people we are closely related to. Can I request Kenny to respond to the second question?
Thank you, Deputy Minister, and thank you, Honourable Chair. The question around what happens. Remember, part of our intention here, and again, I'm making clear, it's our intention, and we need to put that in place. Part of our difficulty is we report, and so what? And who takes them seriously? All of those regulations and all of the work we're doing here through the units is to ensure that we strengthen compliance and we strengthen enforcement. And by reporting to Parliament and the oversight body on a six-monthly basis, we're also placing a responsibility on the oversight body to call these organizations to account. We'll be able to report and say, yes, in Department B, we've identified 20 employees that are conducting business with the state. We've informed them, and to date, no action has been taken against these employees. So the responsibility then is becomes more visible, and departments will then take it more seriously in terms of enforcement and compliance. Chair, you're absolutely correct. Our intention is not to rewrite things. We'll be using lots of the work that we've already done in terms of the public service regulation, and we'll extend it to include the three spheres of government, whether it's on the RWOPs, the remunerative work outside the employee's department. Remember, we've also identified a number of activities that are not constituted as doing business with the state. For example, a teacher was marking metric exams. So you have two separate employment contracts there, as a teacher and as a marker for metric. So we've excluded that activity from doing business in this case. So we've done, and all of that work will then move into to this work. You notice even in my presentation, The intention is to strengthen the current Public Service Regulations 2016 and then move that into local government. So the idea is not to reinvent the wheel. We're simply building on what we currently have and hopefully strengthening it and improving on it going forward. Thank you, Chair.
I'm not fully answered on an employee who must be charged with misconduct for the spouse, not for the spouse, for a person living with okay. Can you clarify? Just deal with an ideal situation, not a hypothetical situation. And why do you want to punish a victim? I mean, you tell somebody you stay with, you are not married, you have got no legal contract. And in the main, you find it will be women who will be found to be on the receiving end by men who refuse to say, why must I disclose? I've got no legal obligation to disclose my financial interests and whatever to you. And then you, as Public Service Administration, charges this poor woman for misconduct. Why? Why not charge the perpetrator and charge the victim? Explain that in simple terms. Just look at an ideal situation. Because it's easy to see things here in writing. But in a normal situation, it might not be as easy as we see it here in the boardroom. Explain to us how that is going to be operationalized.
Chair, thank you. Sorry.
I missed that. The current South African law recognizes, marriages, and it also recognizes partners. In the public service regulations and the public service prescripts, in terms of various benefits that are afforded to spouses, we also expand that definition to include partners that are living with the individual. So in this context, we still need to recognize that. And remember, the main principle that we're trying to address in this particular piece of legislation is the management of conflict of interest. So as a live-in spouse or as a live-in partner, you have the ability to influence a decision-making. And that's what we want to control. That's the only issue we want to address. Your ability to influence a decision-making at some point. And we're trying to manage that and prevent that from happening. And therefore the disclosure of financial interests of spouse or a partner. Because it amounts to the same thing. Whether you live as common law husband and wife or you live as partners, you share the same relationship and the influence is still there, and there's a possibility of influence, and we're trying to manage. The question you're asking, in a practical sense, remember that the onus is on the employee to disclose as far as he or she is aware of what that financial interest is. He or she cannot disclose what he or she is not aware of. So as Kenny married to another individual outside or living together with somebody else, in discussions with the individual, I identified, please tell me what your financial interests are in terms of these categories, and whatever is told to me, we will disclose. If there's a dispute that comes up at some stage, there's a conflict that is picked up, and the individual as the employee was not aware of it, I think it will come out through that disciplinary hearing. Or that, remember, any disciplinary hearing must give the employee an opportunity to respond. And we will then pick it up there and deal with it. Chair, you're right. It's going to be a difficult one to manage. I know we've raised this with Professor Alton Shiro, who's advising us on all of this legislation and regulations as well. It's going to be very difficult to manage, and it's something that I think we'll have to deal with through precedence as we go along. But you're right, you're picking up a real challenge. And even in the consultation processes, female employees in particular raise this challenge. Many of them told us in no uncertain terms, I don't know what my husband does. I'm not sure how many businesses he has, what's his income, where it comes from, whatever. So it's something we'll have to manage. It's in the law, so we'll have to find ways of implementing the law. It's in the law. and it was passed by Parliament. So we'll have to look at it from an administrative perspective of how we give effect to that law. And some of these things through practice, we may have to come back and say, sorry, this cannot work, we need to change it. But we can only do that once we start implementing. So we're looking at how we deal.
Deputy Minister.
Chairperson, the same challenge that you are worried about in terms of the living in partners is the challenge that you can still experience with your spouse who does not want you to stay with you. What is good here is that this clause does not criminalize. It actually puts it as a requirement. And Rishi, I'm sure it actually could be looked at something that promotes BAJA requirements, promotion of access to justice act. So that when you've got to be faced with a situation and you've got to be prosecuted, matters of this nature are actually taken into consideration. But this clause does not criminalize it. It just puts it as a requirement.
But it says a misconduct. So it means you have violated the code of conduct if that does not happen. A living spouse refuses, and government happened to establish that is doing business somewhere, but the poor woman is charged with misconduct. Just look at it. I'm not saying that we should turn this into a legal debate. Okay. No, I think we are done with the briefing. Thanks very much, Deputy Minister and your team. Then we'll meet when we come back in August. We are getting into item 4. Okay. Item 4 is briefing by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation on the 30-day, on the 30 payment. Is it not 30-day? 30-day payment to service providers in the public service. Instead of the DG, she's not here. It will be the DDG, known as Dr. Nziki, but her full name is Dr. Nziki China Mashiya. The stage is yours, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning to the honourable members. The apology was tendered for a minister who is dealing with is in cabinet today for the Northwest intervention. The DG is also meeting with the NCOP for the application for the administration of Section 100 in Northwest. This is why I'm representing the department. I'm going to quickly talk about the purpose of this presentation, which is to update the honourable members on the payment of service providers, and also we would like to share what we are doing as the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation to address this challenge of payment of service providers after 30 days. And sometimes non-payment of service providers. I start with making the point that government has identified the small business sector as an important area to grow economy and to reduce unemployment. The NDP specifically puts at the center the small, medium enterprises as the drivers of economy as well. And the challenges that are faced by this sector is that they are paid by government departments and even at municipality level after 30 days, which is not in line with the prescript. And this is what hampers, their contribution to the economy sector. And some of these enterprises end up closing. The Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation is strengthening the unit that was initially run by two people on a part-time basis, but because we have seen the need to interact continuously with the department that are the serial offenders in this space, we have at least put just one senior manager supported by two deputy managers to ensure that we follow up, you know, this work. We also work hand in hand with the Treasury, who are also monitoring this area. Now, recently, we are beginning to engage the Auditor General with their newly adopted by Parliament bill, so that we see how we can criminalize especially the employees of government who contribute to this by actually demanding that the service provider give them something before their invoices are paid. I am not going to waste the time of the members talking about the background. I think it is known that the cabinet resolved that this area must be tracked. And to date, the department has facilitated the payment of over 300 million to service providers. I would like to just highlight that we measure two areas specifically when we are looking at the payment of service providers: the number and rent value of invoices paid after 30 days, and we also look at the number of invoices as well as the rent value of invoices not paid. I have indicated that we source the information from the reports that are submitted to Treasury by national as well as provincial departments. I will quickly start with the performance of national departments. We are reporting to the Honourable Members quarter four, but we have decided to show the members what the picture was in quarter one, what the picture was in quarter two, what the picture was in quarter three, so that the members can be able to see, to have a picture for the whole year. As of quarter four, the number of invoices that we paid after 30 days are 54,306 invoices. And the rent value for that, for those invoices, is 1.3 billion. We make the point that there is an increase in the number of invoices between quarter three and quarter four, but I was just saying that 1.3 billion in the small and medium enterprise sector is a lot of money for those businesses which are small, if they are owed that kind of money. So this is paid, but it's paid later than 30 days. Now the next slide talk to the invoices, the national departments that pay their invoices during the fourth quarter. These departments paid all their invoices, and we decided to list the names here because the honorable members normally say to us we must name and shame those departments that do not pay. So we list those that do the right thing so that they are known. I would like the honorable members to know that we are talking just about the fourth quarter here. So other departments may be in this list. Now they've paid in the fourth quarter, maybe in the previous quarter they did not do well, but in the fourth quarter they paid all their invoices. I will not read the department if the members allow me, because we submitted the report. Then we move to the national departments that have invoices that are more than 30 days but have not been paid. So in quarter four, we've got 14,746 invoices that have not been paid, and the amount that is outstanding that has not been paid is 334 million. Now that is the amount that is being owed. It means those businesses have not been given that money. And some of these businesses, you see that they would struggle in their operations. There are people that have to be paid. But that is what we have realized. And we see that there is an increase between quarter three and quarter four, which if the honorable members look, quarter one, the departments would at least try and pay, because the number of invoices are not paid in quarter one at 9,000. Quarter two, departments looks like they spend their money, because the invoices that are unpaid were reduced to 8,000. But quarter four, the invoices increased up to 14,000. And those are the differences in the amounts owed is quite significant, from 42 million to 334 million in the fourth quarter. Now we name and shame here the departments that have not paid their invoices at the end of the fourth quarter. They are the Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, Department of Water and Sanitation with the highest number of invoices, Department of Police with 11 invoices, Independent Police Investigation Directorate with 197 invoices, Department of Social Development, 31 invoices. So the invoices that really we put to show the picture, but what is important is the figures, the amounts, because we have seen that in other cases there will be fewer invoices, but these invoices will be for bigger amounts. So we see that the Department of Women, for instance, has got just one invoice that shows the, but if you look at the amount that is outstanding, is a lot. So we have showed that those invoices, and we do follow up to find out what kind of service that was offered that end up with just one invoice and that amount. Then we come to the provincial level. Quarter four, we see that there is 57,275 invoices that have not been paid by provincial departments, and that amounts to 5.1 billion. We see that at the provincial level there is a decrease towards the year. So the provinces try and deal with the amounts that are being owed. And we can see both at the level of invoices as well as the amount from the 8.3 billion that was owed beginning of the year, now is 5.1 billion. But we make the point still that is a lot of money for small and medium enterprises. This slide talks to the amount that is still not paid to date. If you were to go to those enterprises, they are still being owed this money by department. Quarter four, 93,000 invoices at the provincial level. And the amount that is still unpaid is 6.7 billion. In this slide, we decided to show the provinces, which are the provinces that are major contributors to the amount owed to service providers. We show there that Gauteng is at the forefront there with 60% of the 100% of amount paid older than 30 days. And then it's followed by Eastern Cape with 15%, followed by KZN with 8%, followed by Free State and Limpopo, and then other provinces. Yeah. So we actually wanted to see in the overall picture which one are the main problematic provinces. And we saw that while Gauteng has been significantly ahead of other provinces, gradually the Eastern Cape and KZN are slowly getting into that space of not paying and having huge amounts owed. In this slide, we show by sector which are these departments in the provinces that contribute to the picture that we see. If, for instance, we say that Gauteng is at the front owing with 67%, so which are the departments in Gauteng that are contributing to the picture? We see that health is contributing largely with 93%. And education follows with 6%. We look at the Eastern Cape, again we see that health is at 98% contributing to give us the picture that we see at health. We go to Limpopo, we see again that health is at 98%. Then we look at other provinces, Free State, health 71%, Mpumalanga, have 96%. From this, we then saw that the health problem is a national issue. The health owing their service providers is a national problem. Then DPME had to initiate a project to get the DGs from all the provinces to deal with what is causing this problem at health, because it's national. Education follows in department, but if you look at Free State, it's significant. It's 23%. Northwest education becomes 98%. Western Cape education 84%. Northern Cape, yes, education is also high in terms of the contribution. So we showed so that we understand the sectors. Public works also tends to contribute in the number of invoices that are not paid in the provinces that owe people. So those sectors, others contribute, their contribution is non-significant, but the three are really the areas that we have to probe more and look. And when we ask the questions in the public works, the reasons is they vary from the extension of the scope, the variation orders, and all of those issues that make the payments to be outstanding for a long time. Now, when we interact with the department to find out why, so that we can assist in resolving the issue, we have identified the medical legal claims to be the reason that all national departments cite that there is high litigation for the doctors. And then they also raise that their budget is actually consumed. They go beyond the budget because of the cross-border issues, that they have people who come in who are not budgeted for, and then they make them to expand their budget. The area of health and social development, cash flow challenges resulting in accruals in those departments already that are overrun in terms of their cash flow, and then they don't pay. But we have identified, when we look at the annual reports of departments, that they are elements of poor internal controls. We have seen also the poor administrative processes when they give us the excuses, but when we look at their reports, annual reports, and the AG's reports, we see that poor administrative processes have contributed. And we make the very strong point that if there would be consequence management to those managers who receive invoices and hold on to them, it would reduce this picture. So we dealt with the issue of consequence management in the recommendations that we make. So under summary and conclusion, we have listed the departments that are responsible for 334 million. The Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, Agriculture and Forestry, Forest and Fisheries, Water and Sanitation, EPID, Department of Social Development, Department of Public Works, Department of Women. We listed those departments because we feel they have to be made to give account of how they become overrun in their finances. The health sector, we have discussed the matter of the health sector and the initiative that has been taken by DPME to address the national issue at health. And we make the last comment that while Gauteng is responsible for 52% in the payments that are over 30 days, but data is now beginning to show that KZN, Northwest, Free State, Eastern Cape and Limpopo are also beginning to gradually increase on the number of invoices that are paid after 30 days and those that are unpaid. In the work that we are doing to deal with this challenge, we are engaging the departments that are not complying. We have one-on-ones with them, we engage their DGs. We have now taken a step further, we have included this payment of service provider in the performance agreement of DGs. DGs have just signed now the performance agreement for the new financial year, and this area has been included, the payment of 30 days as their performance measurement. And we are exploring mechanisms now with the AG to actually root out the corruption, because from the side of the service providers, we've been informed that there are officials who want the service providers to first attend to them before they can pay their service providers. So we want to ensure that in cases like that, the law takes its course and those officials are dealt with. That is the work that we are presenting before this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dike Mashir. Members, just a briefing. Can we engage the presentation, questions, inputs? Honorable Khosa, Honorable Mtau, Honorable Nivot.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks, Dr. Dike, for the presentation. Chair, the poor internal control are cited as the main reasons for the non-payment of suppliers on time. Then my question would be, whose responsibility is that to ensure that sound internal control are in place in the department? Are the DGs and HODs not responsible to execute their powers conferred by the PFMA to the government officials? And also, your report does not show a number of officials disciplined for not executing their responsibilities for the payments of the suppliers. Then who should do this? The DGs and HODs are measured, Chairperson, on the performance of these key indicators. One will also ask as to how many were disciplined on the basis of the unpaid invoices to suppliers. The second issue I wanted clarity, Doc, if you can open slide 14, I need the clarity issue I wanted to talk to. I did not understand something on slide 14. It's with regard to the 0% from Northwest, Northern Cape, and Western Cape. My problem is with regard to Northwest. Why is that 0%? What does it mean? That is 13. Go to 14. Yeah. I think it's here. On health, Northwest 0%. Can you maybe clarify me for better understanding? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Khosa, Honorable Mtau.
Thank you, Chair. Just a trend thing. Between quarter three and quarter four, as you indicated, there's a jump there. Is it a one-off in this year, or is it a trend every year that it happens like that? Because then we have to find out what happened between 3 and 4. I don't know if you guys have done work in that regard. And you preempted my other question, but I still need to get something. You're looking into this 2.2 million unpaid things for the women in the Department of Women. It's just one invoice, and you guys are still looking into what it is. So you will give us feedback on that. Okay. Clearly something is being done which is right in the Western Cape, because they seem to score the best of all these. Have you tried to establish from them what it is they are doing to keep to do the things right, and maybe it's something that you could share with the other provincial departments to do? I see they only had four in education which they didn't pay, which is bad. You know, they're supposed to pay everything, but maybe it's something that can be looked at. The thing that I would ask and urge that you push as hard as you indicate you'll be doing, the reference to one of the big problems, lack of consequence management. We know that, and we have to look at it, and you guys are doing something about it. It's one of those things that when these officials have signed these agreements, the performance agreements, then somebody's got to go check and make sure that they're done, and if they don't, then they have to be a bit of stick rather than carrot. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Tao. Honorable question.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. I would like to add to the questions already asked by Honorable Khosa related to the poor internal controls. I would like to find out what exactly that means, and the same with poor administrative processes. What does that exactly mean? Why I'm asking in particular with these phrases, it's related to my next question, so just hold on to that. I have a question about what does the 0% mean, you know, especially in health, because we see on the news the Northwest, the health department is in tatters, people are striking, no payments, etc. So what does the 0% mean in your graph, and also public works as well, is reflecting a 0%, if you can explain that. And the cross-border claims, can you give an example? You know, what claims are done for cross-border, what's the implication for the cross-border issue, or why is that an excuse? So back to administrative processes, I want to give you an example. I came to this committee in 2016, and that was just after the committee had public hearings about this 30-day payments. So I brought up in that that the Deaf Federation of South Africa has many unpaid invoices. And at that time in 2016, the total amount was 500,000 of unpaid invoices. And there was we did a follow-up with the Deaf Federation, and now they still owed 200,000. And it's different departments and municipalities are included who are owing this amount. So my question is, and I've asked the Deaf Federation of South Africa to explain what exactly happened. An example that they gave is that when the departments are merged, who then takes responsibility for the outstanding invoices or the invoices that haven't been paid? Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities was closed and moved to Department of Social Development. And DEFSA had invoices from Department of Women, Children and DWCPD. When it closed and was moved to Social Development, then DEFSA followed up with Social Development for the payment of those invoices. And Social Development said all those order numbers do not match what is on their computer system, so they will not pay those invoices. So that's the hurdle that DEFSA is left with. Secondly, Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities, they would have a national event, for example. But the department doesn't have the capacity to organize the event themselves, so they hire an events organizing company to handle that. The event organizer then contracts DEFSA to arrange the interpreters for this event. But now, because the department hasn't paid the event organizing company, that company is closed now, doesn't exist anymore, the event company. But DEFSA's invoice So DEFSA has paid its suppliers before the 30 days, hoping that the department or the events company will make good on that invoice. But this company doesn't exist anymore. So DEFSA wants to find out what happens to the claims, what happened to this invoice, who does it go to in order that it gets paid. And then in terms of the supply chain managers, I don't want to go into the operational, but I want to understand that if this is part of poor administrative processes or poor internal controls, if the supply chain manager who is responsible to call for the tenders or issue the tenders, etc., and then the companies submit their documents, invoice, in quotes, etc., the supply chain manager approves the quote, the event happens, or whatever it is happens, the supply chain manager now moves to a new job, a new position, wherever. The new supply chain manager takes over and then tells DEFSA or tells the company that, I don't know you, so I'm not going to pay you. And that also causes delays. So who must assist the departments or the people who are making invoices? Because we don't know what happens in the department. I mean, the suppliers just need their invoices to be paid so they can survive and move on. So DEFSA coordinates interpreting service. If there's no payment to DEFSA, the same department will later ask for the interpreter. But DEFSA can't say to the department, you haven't paid our previous invoice, we can't give you a service. DEFSA has to give the service because it's deaf people who need access to information. So then DEFSA can't pay their own staff because the department is owing so much money. So it doesn't bankrupt only SMMEs, it bankrupts NGOs, this behavior of non-payment. So, and these organizations, NGOs, have no voice, they have no say. So please, I'm honestly requesting you, please investigate that and advise DEFSA and other NGOs how to take up these kind of tricky situations. No, I've checked their unpaid invoices, go back to 2012. It's not being fair to organizations who serve the people. So please look into that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Nivot. Okay, Dr. Mashia, those are the questions and comments. Can you briefly respond? Try to be short, because I don't want a situation where we are left very few. I mean, remember this week, Parliament is rising, so members have got challenges with flight arrangements. You know, there's no longer express, and people have to connect long distances. And we still have another presentation on the NYTA bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief. May I just start by saying that the DEFSA issue is a specific issue. Fortunately, we deal with the complaints. I will register it as a complaint and make sure that it's investigated, and we then give feedback on that level. I listened to it and I've recorded it. The question on the officials that must be disciplined, Honorable is quite right. The DGs, PFMA is specific about what needs to happen if people do not comply with the payment within 30 days. It's a PFMA matter. And PFMA is also clear on the roles of the accounting officer. So this is why we have put this on the performance agreement of the accounting officer, because whilst PFMA is in there, accounting officers knowing their responsibility, but they were not contracting with their managers on this in some areas. So now the DG contracts, the CFO, the senior managers. So if people have not complied, then they're going to be disciplined. That's what we have done now. So the DGs, the accounting officers, are responsible for disciplining officials who do not ensure, the managers who do not ensure that the payments within their units or branches are made within the specified time. So I want to say that to the honourable members, now that is in the contract, there is no way that the DGs are going to talk outside it. It's in the contract. It just has to be done. The percentage, I am worried when the honourable member talks about the Northwest, because now I have to talk to the specifics there. There is 0% there is because in the Northwest, the departments there, they outsourced the payment of providers to the, I think they have PMUs. I don't know if the honourable members heard about the PMUs. Yeah. So they themselves have got no responsibility of paying the PMU. So if you ask the departments, they'll tell they don't have the invoices that are outstanding. So it's a matter that is being investigated now by the SIU, how it happened that departments have got that, a PMU, that took over the procurement process. So that's how they would register. I want to believe that they would be like other provinces having invoices that are hanging and not paid. So in terms of submitting the report to Treasury, they would report, remember we said the report is submitted to Treasury, they would report that they are not owing, they do not have invoices that are overdue. The Department of Women, Honourable Mdau, we had to really investigate. The amount was bigger than that initially. It was 10 million. Then they told us they have cleared the other part, but it's still one invoice. So we want to know who are the providers, who is this provider, and what did this service provider do. We will submit this report, because the question of finding out what services was offered to that amount. Western Cape, I think we have made this observation that Western Cape and even Northern Cape, they have been fairly consistent in having a low number of invoices that are paid after 30 days. So we put it in the foresight that other DGs need to really engage with those DGs. In terms of the processes, what is it that the DGs do constantly to make sure that the payments are made? So it was Western Cape, it was also Northern Cape that were consistently having low invoices that are not paid. Even in the management practices, they were seen to be doing well in terms of the financial management practices, procurement, supply chain. So we put it to the foresight to say they must share with the other DGs. So we are in that path of sharing best practices. Thanks. The consequent management, Honourable Mdau is quite correct. And I think that as government broadly, not just DPME, DPSA, we have to work together to strengthen that area of consequent management, because it is not like we do not have the instruments. The instruments are there. Is the culture within the public sector, is this thing of people not being able to meet a punishment to other, because consequence management is needed when someone has to be disciplined. And this is the culture, I think, with the programs that are being implemented, that is really going to ensure that people do take, I think, their responsibility in terms of accounting. Just something that may not be here today, but is linking to this specifically. The way DPSA has done now the signing of agreements, specifically what the DG has to do, specifically what the chief director has to do, specifically what the... So it is more specific now. So at the time of assessment, it's no longer to say in the CMCs I'll have financial management good P people management, project management, you must be specific about the things that you are going to do in those areas. And so it has to be tested in the very first round of assessment now. What have you done about those specific things? Because, Honorable Mudau, I know with HR you look into those things. You, Honorable Truche, Truche, in the previous agreement, it would be a very fluid statement at the level of a director, chief director, DDG, you apply the CMCs. But you were not specific to say, what are you going to do in line with these CMCs? Now, that is what has changed. And this directive from DPSA, it has assisted in the crafting of this round of agreements. And the test is going to be in the very first assessment. And no one is going to be able to escape because now everything is specific. So consequence management has to follow. The Chair, the last one is the cross-border examples. I think it's the Honorable who requested the cross-border examples. So budget is allocated firstly according to the populations in some sectors. So the health sector and the social development sector, they put it that they end up expanding on people they did not budget for, who came through, I think, illegally even, you know, through the borders. They site in the borders in around Matatiel and the other borders because they say they access the health services. They don't even have the identity document. They don't produce identity document. You know, when you're accessing a health service, you must produce identity. If you're supposed to pay a minimal fee. When you don't have that fee and you don't have the ID, they don't have a way of following up to recover, the health facility to recover its money. So that money then becomes a debt that remains and until it has to be just written off. So this is what is going to be also consuming in the health budget. Of course, with I think the HR staff that they say that they have to get specialists in the HR space in the health sector, then that make them to overspend their budget. So health sector, they always operate beyond what current cash flow that they have. If I would put it in the language of overdraft, it's like they make operations to run with the budget they don't have. That's why the problem is the same in the health sector nationally. But that is being addressed at the national level. But in terms of cross-border, is the illegal immigrants that have to be provided for in the health system. Perhaps what I omitted to say is that PCC has given a task to a task team to investigate how much of this problem is the actual problem, and so that they are specific, so that we don't make assumptions. So there is a task team that's working on that and is reporting to the IMC on immigration and that. So they will be having a report to say how much of a problem is the problem that we say we are experiencing in terms of catering for the nationals that we have not budgeted for. So that, again, there's a policy decision that is taken in terms of whether we have to claim for those from their countries or whether there can be an arrangement that will be made country to country. So there's work that is going on in that aspect. Perhaps that's what I omitted to say. So we will come and report that once that report. That report is going to be tabled in the very next, in the PCC, that is in June. So that work has started. There's a research that is being done. It's going to be tabled in the PCC of June. So we will then report on that issue, you know, in the how the cross-border affects the overspending. And then the department say when they don't have money in their cash flow, that is when then they can't pay the service providers. That's where the link is.
Sorry, Chair, just to follow up on that.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Okay. Okay, done. Sorry. I thought you were done.
Okay. Yes, I'm done. I think I'm done, Chair, with the issues. The internal controls. The department did not raise this issue, but we took from those departments that have not paid departments, we took the Auditor General's report, and then we took the annual reports of those departments. We compared if those departments had not sent back money to Treasury, either not sent back money to Treasury, or have not had areas of under expenditure. And then we realized that had the the accounting officer actually ensured that the managers are held accountable for ensuring that their providers are paid, it could have been a different picture. So it's where we saw cases where service providers are not owed, but we see that there's a small amount that has been either handed back to Treasury or that that has been captured as under expenditure. So this is why now we have decided to tie the DGs to ensure that they contract with all the managers on the payment specifically of service providers within 30 days to deal with that issue. To ensure that as a manager, if I get an invoice from my service provider, I follow it through to until I see that my service provider that provided service for my branch is paid. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Nimrod, follow up.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing me to have a follow-up. I would like to go to the written report from the DPME dated April 2018. The written report says, I'm not sure which page, but before point four, the conclusion, the written report says, Northwest Department of Health has not yet submitted data at the time of reporting. Okay, so that's what it says here in the written report. So was that the reason when you talk about PMU? Now, if the department has not submitted data, I thought that DPME was doing an analysis of the whole 30-day payment issue. So you must give a time frame when you must receive all the documents to make this analysis. So I'm just curious about why it hasn't been updated. And also, it's not only the Department of Health that has zero, but it's also other departments like Public Works. Public Works in the Free State is also zero. Limpopo, there's zero. So what is the reason for that zero? It's not only specifically the Department of Health, but others as well. So what is the specific reasoning behind that? And then as you explained with regard to the cross-border, now it seems that departments lack the income, which is not really the claims that they are not paying. So we are looking at the 30-day payments that the departments are supposed to make to service providers. Now, because they don't have enough revenue from people coming to use the service, like in the hospital, for example, they can't pay within 30 days. But in every department, they have a budget to make payments. So I'm just curious about, you say, you know, there's a lack of revenue or there's no address, they can't, you know, follow up with people to pay for their services, but they're supposed to pay their service providers from a specific budget as well. So just want clarity. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. Michelle.
The Department of Health is, I think we have said in the previous meetings, Chair, the first main contributor, what consumed their budget, is the litigation. Because in litigation, they are forced to pay. That's where 90% of their budgets go. So they are trying to get revenue to address the errors. This is why we say it's a system, it's a national problem. And we showed that, in fact, in most provinces, in fact, the investigation showed that there is a syndicate of lawyers in South Africa that is helping the people to sue government, you know, for negligence. I think just as a country, maybe we also identify this challenge a bit late, because we all know in the U.S. that is what it is. if they help people, even if a person was operated so many years ago, they can just get the x-rays and see the misalignment and have the person sue the state to say this was not supposed to be done this way. So now it's a country-wide phenomenon. There are those lawyers who are just specializing on doing this. And so when it's litigation, it's a must, you have to, because there will be a court order that you must just pay. The issue of Northwest, I've explained. I would not go back to it. In other provinces, as I've said, we take the report that is submitted to Treasury. So Treasury is the one that has got a regulation that departments must periodically submit information to Treasury. So if at the time of consolidating and analyzing the report for here, Treasury does not have the report, we will not have the report because they do not submit to us, they submit to Treasury. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Maybe in conclusion, probably one can propose that why don't we meet these departments so that they speak for themselves? Rather than you speaking for them. Because departments will collapse under our noses. And the question will be asked, what did you do in regard to oversight? Probably we might have to meet them in the third quarter. Perhaps explain how does immigration have to do with invoices. I'm struggling to understand immigration and paying an invoice to a supplier. Water affairs, there's no more money in that department. It's just auto-piloting. Education is not spending money. I have the report which I got when I was in appropriations. They are not spending it. I think Honorable Koza is in that portfolio. It's there from Treasury analyze. So I think Secretary, let's find space in the new program to invite this department so that we can compile our own report. You see, we don't just listen to you and keep quiet and it ends there. We represent the public. The question is, now that we got this report, what are we saying as public representatives? That's very, very important. So I think we'll create that space for the departments to come and appear before the portfolio committee and speak for themselves. And we'll have to make findings and recommendations. I think we'll also invite you with the assistance of Treasury so that we're able to have a scientific analysis of what they are presenting. Okay, thank you very much. Let's move to the next presentation on the update by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation and the National Youth Development Agency on the progress made thus far in amending the National Youth Development Agency Act number 54. Of 2008. I'm not sure who'll start with it. There are two doctors, there's a deputy chairperson, Madam Bongwa, there is a CEO.
We allow the DG to go on.
Which DG? Dr. Zig. Okay, Captain Mashia.
Let me just introduce Dr. Sakala to talk through to the NYDA Act, the progress, and as the Deputy Chair said, NYDA then will then support coming.
Dr. Penis, present.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members and colleagues. Today we are here to report progress on amendment of the National Youth Development Agency Act. In terms of the background, you'll recall that the NYDA was established through the measure of the National Youth Commission and the Umsobomvu Youth Fund, and the founding legislation is the NYDA Act, Act number 54 of 2008. However, after the existence of the National Youth Development Agency, it was realized that there are challenges, particularly in relation to execution of the mandate as legislated. It was then proposed that we should begin the process of amending the NYDA Act. In amending this act, the executive authority established a task team which consists of the DPME, Presidency, NYDA, National Treasury, DPSA, as well as COFTAS. And the reason for amending the act first was to look at the broad mandate of the NYDA, particularly in relation to programs that are offered by other youth development institutions. We know that youth development is not the sole responsibility of the NYDA, but also of other stakeholders like government departments, NGOs, as well as the private sector. And the other reason was to also scale up service provision to reach young people at local level, particularly young people at in deep rural areas. It was realized that young people are not accessing the services and products of the NYDA adequately, and also to address other challenges in relation to the practical implementation of the Act. Currently, the NYDA has got 17 branches that are offering products and services at provincial level. However, these are inadequate given that we've got many young people, and therefore there remains a gap on accessing NYDA products and services, particularly for young people in deep rural areas. And then the other problem is that when it comes to youth development, NYDA is mainly held responsible, whereas other stakeholders like government, they are not held responsible. How in government we still have problems such as poor mainstreaming of youth development programs and services. And this is mainly due to inadequate human and financial resources, as well as poorly skilled personnel. And the budgets that are allocated to departments, they are often not youth responsive. Again, there are also disparities in service provision for the NYDA, resulting in a lack of uniformity when it comes to service rendering. And this has resulted in limited impact for youth development programs. Therefore, when amending the Act, there are various considerations that we have made. First is to make sure that we expand the products and services of the National Youth Development Agency to reach provincial as well as local levels. NYDA has made submissions in order on how these products will be established, through ensuring that there are branches as well as district offices in municipalities, and also strengthening the entire youth development machinery in the country to ensure that youth development is institutionalized as well as mainstreamed, and to also strengthen coordination mechanisms. Progress made so far is that the NYDA made a submission to the task team proposing areas of amendment for the NYDA Act, and these provisions have been considered, and a submission will then be made to the minister for approval of the provisions. And then once approved, a socio-economic impact study will be conducted. There will also be a submission to the Office of the Chief State Law Advisors to request certification and legal opinion, and the bill will then be submitted to Parliament via Cabinet. And with regard to Section 75 and Section 76, the NYDA will leave that to Parliament to make determination on how to take the amended Act. In conclusion, I would like to report that policy decisions on the proposed areas of amendment for the NYDA Act still has to be taken, and there is also a need to engage with all relevant key stakeholders once the bill has been drafted, and then the bill will then be processed to Parliament via Cabinet. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. So it's an update. There is no bill before us. And this is a bill that is not initiated by Parliament. I want to set the parameters very clear so that we don't start a discussion on the bill which is not before us. There is an intention to initiate an amendment bill. So it's an update. Okay. Members, that's it. That's an update. Madam, we start with the procedures that you have presented. We start with members. Then if there are questions for clarity and comments, then we come to you. You get the procedure?
I don't want to have a dialogue with you, but you have said you will present any comments to me. That's what we had indicated when we started. And then we will comment, and then we'll then continue.
Oh, you want to make?
Yes, that's what we had agreed earlier when we started.
Oh, I didn't understand.
No, it's fine, Chair. It's your meeting. We'll comment afterwards.
Okay, take 5 minutes and make the addition.
Yeah. I think, Chair, there's been work. I hear your comment, but if I may just start there, there's been a lot of work that has been done on trying to review the Act. I think when the process to appoint the sitting board started, this process started, which was about 2015, I think. And it had on stops, starts and stops somewhere. But it's continuing from there. And as Dr. B has just said, we're looking at particular areas. But I think what is worth noting to this particular committee is that around Section 75 and Section 76 of the Act, it's because there's been 6 different approaches in terms of how to deal with spreading the accessibility of the NYDA and its existence and its funding, and that's why you find that there remains a question mark on how that should move forward, because when you take it to provinces through making it Section 76, you mean you will appoint the national board, and then provinces will appoint provincial boards, and then how do you coordinate that? How do you work with this kind of a structure with the character of young people that we have? And the discussion that we had last at the level of the NYDA board was to say, look, probably it's not the best of best things to make it a Section 76, but keep it as a national entity that will spread through offices. But the challenge of funding remains one of the biggest ones that we do not have a solution for. We've proposed some things, and some of those things that we've proposed, we are told that they are not doable. But I think when a deeper presentation into the bill itself comes to this particular committee, we'll probably be able to take this committee through in terms of our proposals, in terms of where the money should come from, because we cannot continually cry about how much the NYDA does not have funds to take youth development to young people, but also have no proposed solutions. We must find a way of doing that. And then I think the issue of reporting was one of the areas as well, but I think our submission to the to that particular committee that is doing work will eventually land into this particular committee, then we can get into the discussion. But I think that's where the issue of the bill is, and I think we'll have a lot of support from this particular committee, which I think will be very appreciated. And look, at the end of the day, the responsibility of youth development, even in the current act, when you look into Section 7, the state, the private sector and civic organizations should be doing work and even giving us a report. But I can tell you, I've looked back, you know, as far back as on the day of establishment. There's never been a report from government in terms of youth development. And I think the attempt that we've just made was last year. We started last year to try and get a government department to say what are they doing in the space of youth development. Probably that's why you'll find that there's catering, you know, there's a festival of different things and the festival of youth summits that will sit everywhere. You could see the list of invites that we receive to come to summits, which are not youth development, and people will then tick the box and life goes on, which has been the case since I don't know, as far back as I remember. Those are some of the things that probably when we get to the details of what we are proposing, we will come through in terms of what we are proposing from the side of young people as a way of going forward, probably expanding much more on the issue of the Section 7 of this particular act. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Chair. Mr. CEO, is there anything you want to say? So that we should not leave here and say these old people suppress the answers. I was once the youth, so now I'm a bit old. So I might say things before I say.
Chairperson, I would never accuse you of being old, Chairperson. But maybe just one thing is to, on behalf of the NYDA, maybe just to congratulate you, Honourable Chair, on your appointment as the Chair of the Committee. We wish you all the best on behalf of young people of South Africa.
Thanks. Honourable members of the Honourable Khoso, Honourable Mtao, Honourable Nifo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks, Tom, for the presentation. Chairperson, I personally do not have questions, but to just appreciate the initiative by the NYDA for the amendment so that going forward they will be able to discharge their responsibilities without any hindrance. Mm-hmm. And further believe that the poor mainstreaming that has been said of their programs will be in future bear fruit, as well as the scaling up of service provision, more especially in rural areas where they are scarcely visible. We just believe as a committee that this will be, they are trying to do good for the constituency that they are representing, that is the youth. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Khoso. Honourable Tao.
Thank you very much. Don't let the tagging bother you, whether it's 75 or 76. Do what you guys need to do, and then when you take it to the lawyers and the treasury, they will tell you whether to take it 75 or 76. You do what you believe is the best thing that you want to do, and we'll see it through the process.
Thank you, Montau. Honourable Edward.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. It's puzzling to me to ask questions because I don't have a bill in front of me, and I don't have an idea of the amendments that are going to be proposed, and I don't have any of that in front of me. In the problem statement, point five in the problem statement, if you read that, it's difficult to say what in the bill needs to be amended. I say this because if I go to the National Youth Policy of 2015 to 2020, the legislation says the NYDA Act of 2008 mandates the NYDA to develop integrated youth development machinery for South Africa. And it's that initiative, and then to design, coordinate, evaluate, and monitor all programs. And then it goes on, and then it says, the Act instructs the agency to promote uniformity, a uniform approach to the development in all organs of state, private sector, and NGOs. So if we have this, then what is not happening? Why do you say you're not getting reports? It's not being mainstreamed. You're not getting assistance. The rural areas, there's no reach to the rural areas. So I still need to get a full understanding of what is the issue, because how will the amendments then assist, amendments to the Act, how will they assist you in achieving these areas which you so far have not been able to achieve? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Mifot. Can the team respond, all of you from DPM? So it's not Dr. Penis.
I'll start with the question of Honourable Benjamin. Can we, on the issue of the NYDA Act and the mainstreaming of youth development, I think, I don't know whether I should say the Act was badly written or it was not properly understood. But when it comes to one of the issues that, let's take responsibility first. One of the issues that has always been outstanding from the side of the NYDA is the Integrated Youth Development Strategy, which will work as an instruction to all sectors to say these are areas of focus, and then on annual basis we then, you know, concentrate that to say this is their focus for this particular year, and then everyone will then craft their programs aligning themselves to that. That has been outstanding. We've completed the work and it's been submitted now for cabinet approval. So we're waiting for that to come back. That's one exercise that has been outstanding since the establishment of the NYDA, which has been a challenge, and also will then make people say we don't have a national instruction in terms of what we should be doing in the youth development, and hence people will justify the summits, the this and that they are doing that is not assisting us. I know that we are not looking at the, you know, bill itself and the area, but from the side of the NYDA, what we believe we should be looking at is one of them is the issue of Section 7 to a bit expand it and give it a bit of clarity in terms of when you say there's a role of the state, the private sector, the civic organization in youth development, what are you saying they should be doing? You know, be specific. But also, this Act of ours is toothless. There's no way of saying when people do not do youth development, then what will happen? Which I think are issues that were raised by DPSA and DPME around consequence management. There's no such. Yes, we sit squarely nicely in the presidency, and the Act says we report to the president. And part of the reason we were made to report to the president, it was so that this particular agent will be able to hold people accountable. But that is not happening. Probably it needs to as well, you know, start speaking about issues of dealing with those who do not want to address the issues of youth development. And then I think it's the issue of the section as well, whether it should be Section 75 or 76. But I like the approach of Honourable Ndawu to say, look, let's go and propose what we believe is going to assist us move youth development at the pace that we wish it was moving at, and then allow then the legalities and the committees of parliament to then advise us, because it will then be structuring that in a way that is acceptable with the systems of the country, rather than saying we cannot think we are limited by the systems. I think that approach is going to assist us. And the big challenge, which well is a known challenge and there are decisions around it, is the issue of how do we fund. Probably at some point we need to be able to speak to that in terms of where the funds should come from. Because if you say the NYDA, we came here the last time we were here and we said we will be opening 15 offices. Yes, we'll open 15 offices. We obviously going to be speaking to other government departments to try and get rent-free space and so forth. But and then we are going to send staff there. But at the end of the day, it's not going to change the fact that you can only give 50 grants per province. It's not going to change that fact. Now, with all young people that will be, you have more influx of young people that are applying for these grants, that are looking for this service and that service, you are still going to have limited resources. That's the challenge that we are still going to be able to, we are still going to deal with. But we'll deal with it, we have to. And then I think the issue of reporting, we're going to leave it as the way that it is. I've spoken to what Ubabomita has spoken about, and the Honorable next to me, what do we need to be amended. And then there are other areas that will not necessarily have come from the NYDA in terms of the areas that, but when we do the presentation, when we bring the actual bill, I think we'll be able to then engage those particular areas. I think I've answered most of the questions. I think there will be a few more that you probably want to go through, Dr. Thanks.
Thank you, Deputy Chairperson. Who else wants to respond to the issues raised by members?
Okay. Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to say that we really apologize that we cannot go into the details of the content because we still have to request for policy decisions to be taken in that regard. But on what has been raised regarding how this Act is going to assist us in scaling up service provision, I just want to say that there is the current provisions of the original Act places a huge burden on the NYDA. The fact that the NYDA is responsible for policy making, also for promoting uniform approach, I think by implication it is saying that the NYDA should also be responsible for development of the nonsense standards. And we are saying that in addressing that, when we amend the Act, we will also look at the mandate of the NYDA so that which is policy function and is the responsibility of government can be shifted to government, and then the NYDA can focus on intensifying service provision, being more focused on scaling up services such as entrepreneurship, national youth service, grant financing for young people.
Okay. While you are doing all those amendments of the Act, young people are suffering the scourge of unemployment, as we have stated here. So many young people are unemployed. At least government has been able to deal with the issue of fee-free higher education to a certain extent. And we've seen many young people having access to higher education. But the issue of unemployment is very serious in this country, and in the main it affects young people. And at the right time, we'll have to discuss as to what we have been amending youth
legislations, I don't know how many times since we started with the Youth Commission, Chairperson and the CEO. I've been involved with these processes before when I was young. And I don't know, we'll have to be told whether it's an institutional framework problem, is it a policy problem, is it a funding problem, is it a legislation problem, and all these things that we have taken from 1996 to now, young people continue to be affected by problem of unemployment, access to entrepreneurial opportunities. So at the right time, because there's no bill in front of us, we don't want to preempt how the bill should look like. It's not for our, it's not our responsibility. When draft the bill, it goes through the state law drafters, and then the advisors. There are processes that it must go through, and then goes to cabinet, come and present here. Then we'll engage on some of these issues that you might find what you are raising is not the problem. The problem is budget. There's no enough money to implement the policy. You can change the bill several times, but that will not mean anything. But now you have to attend to issues of young people, their needs. Just, I don't know whether you have a portal where if a young person presses, he or she is able to get all the opportunities that are there, job opportunities, study opportunities, and all those, despite that we don't have money. But just be creative. We are living in the world of technology. And I believe technology can sometimes be cheaper. I've seen it in India. I've just come back from India 2 months ago. Young people are able to access a lot of opportunities because of the cheap technology that India has. Unlike here, where Tata is just like paying the water to buy that. In India, it's very cheap. And I don't see, I don't hear you talking about a campaign that data must be cheap. It's other people who are talking about it. There are radio DJs and others. You are not running that campaign, I don't know. Let's see programs, CEO and Chairperson, in the meantime, that address the interests of young people. The month of June should not be about President addressing on June 16th, then it ends there. I say this because I've got lots of interest at heart about the issues of young people as a former leader of young people, and now I've got 2 kids who are youth. So the constituency that we represent, seated here as members of parliament, in the main are young people. So we'll have to find time when you come back and deal with real issues that affect young people, and then if a bill is one of the issues that can address that, convince us, then we'll take the bill to parliament. Once you bring the bill as cabinet, we'll have to take it through the normal processes, and it becomes an act of parliament and the president decides. But this is a very critical matter, because you can see young people all over the world are rising against government because of unemployment in the main and study opportunities. So thanks very much to NYTA and officials from DPMB. We are moving towards...
Can we make a commitment, Chair? Can we make a commitment which will give you an update? Because they are probably showing our meeting for this month, and our focus is not just to be because we are here, the Chair is not here, because we are in the offer to meet some work. So can you make a commitment that when we come the next time, we'll just give you a brief of what our focus is for this particular year, so that at least we don't want, we don't let you, we won't go and dig in what we've submitted in the place of this particular year in the committee. I think that will assist, but briefly for this month, we'll be focusing on taking the NYDA to rural areas. We will not find us in Southeast except for next week. And then we also are launching 7 offices in different provinces across the country. And then we are starting a program that will be responding, we're trying to respond to the abuse and the killing of young women, particularly in institutions of higher level. So we're starting a program around that. There's other programs that we'll be doing in partnership with other stakeholders, but those are our focus areas. So, and then 2016 is done as it's a government, it's a government program that must happen in 2016. But when we come back,
okay. You're making a commitment, Chair. We'll engage with you when we come back, and we'll have to assess how all those activities make an impact on the program and problem of youth unemployment. Yes, we know about those programs, sanitary towels and all this, and high schools and universities, but the problem as we speak, the main problem is youth unemployment. We have got statistics from Stats SA. They are very bad on young people, and we'll have to deal with that. As I've said, on the education front, there's progress in regard to free higher education, or fee-free, and other areas. We acknowledge that, but what about this problem? Because in the NDP talks about the three challenges: inequality, poverty, and unemployment. And all these three challenges affect young people because they cut across the sector. So we have to deal with the NDP as it relates to young people. And we have agreed in this meeting that at some stage we'll have to get NPC to come and present on how far are they in regard to the implementation of the NDP, because we are a few years before 2030. So thanks very much, officials, CEO, and Deputy Chairperson. The last item is six. Honourable members, the officials here will develop a draft program for the third quarter. We'll look at the program circulated amongst members, then we will adopt the program. So we don't have it here, but it will be circulated, so that all what we have been doing throughout as to how do we deal with them before year end, and then come back on the last quarter. And what I've indicated to the Secretariat is to look at the decisions that are outstanding, so that all the decisions that have been taken by this committee before, we look at them and get them implemented. Because people think that we are a toothless board, that don't worry, we'll go and appear before the committee, we'll come back and nothing will happen. And Parliament is a legislative institution with powers. It has got powers like judiciary, it has its powers, executive has its powers. So sometimes people think that honorable members are not problematic. Just go there, eat breakfast with them, engage them, then go home. So I would want us at some stage that officials here summarize all the decisions that have been taken, so that when we come back in the third quarter, say these are the decisions, how do we get them implemented? Then we get into the other programs before we pile so many decisions. So we'll circulate the program. Thanks very much, honorable members and officials. we'll meet again at that called the travel session.